Today on Straight Talk Africa, the challenges of political transitions in Africa. What are some of the key issues that need to be addressed so that social, economic, and political justice for all citizens could be guaranteed on the mother continent? That discussion is coming up next right here on Straight Talk Africa. Hello, welcome to Straight Talk Africa, live from the Voice of America headquarters here in Washington. I am Shaka Sali, and today we are discussing the challenges of political transitions in Africa. There were multiple peaceful transitions of power across Africa in 2018, including Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Mali. There are unprecedented political reforms taking place in Ethiopia as we speak. But 2019 started with an attempted coup in Gabon. Later this year, voters in more than 10 African nations are headed to the polls. My colleague, Paul Ndiho, has more.
The government in Gabon is firmly in control of the country. Following a failed coup attempt on January 7th, a small group of military officers had seized a state radio station to broadcast their displeasure with President Ali Ben Bongo, who is allegedly recovering from a reported stroke in Morocco. A government spokesman says the rebel officers responsible for the coup attempt have been arrested and some killed. The oil-producing African country has been ruled by the Bongo family for nearly half a century. In neighboring Democratic Republic of Congo, people are anxiously awaiting the final official results of the December 30th presidential election. The nation's electoral commission delayed the publication of provincial results on Sunday until it had consolidated all the votes it's receiving from the polling stations. The commission says it has received nearly 50% of the vote tally sheets and it was not yet clear when the results would be ready. The delay is the latest setback in a disorganized poll to elect a successor to President Joseph Kabila, who has ruled the country of more than 80 million people since his father, Laurent Kabila, was assassinated in 2001. President Kabila announced in August 2018 that he would abide by the country's constitution and step aside, opening the door to the Central African nation's first democratic transfer of power. In Sudan, demonstrations calling for President Omar al-Bashir to step down continued for the third week. The anti-government protests first erupted in mid-December over inflation and soaring food and fuel prices. Human rights groups and Amnesty International say more than 30 people have been killed so far in the protests. Meanwhile, the International Foundation for Electoral Systems, or IFES, projects that more than 10 African nations will hold general elections in 2019. Tens of millions of voters are hoping to use the ballot to deepen the quality of democratic governance. Nigeria has Africa's biggest economy, and voters there head to the polls for general elections on February 16th. Political observers are predicting a tight race between incumbent President Muhammadu Buhari and his chief challenge, former Vice President Atiku Abubakar. Buhari, 75, has been in office since 2015. The stakes are high in South Africa as voters gear up for general elections in May. This will be the sixth election held since the end of the apartheid system. The African National Congress Party, which has ruled since 1994, is facing an uphill battle to retain its dominance and proposing constitutional changes to address land issues. South African President Cyril Ramaphosa says the proposed land reform is a lawful process that seeks to correct the legacy of decades of white minority rule that stripped blacks of their land. A nation rebranding is underway in Ethiopia as Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed has embarked on a series of reforms since taking office in April 2018. He's tapped women to head top leadership positions while cracking down on corruption. Perhaps most shockingly, Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed made peace with once a sworn enemy, Eritrea, ending decades of war and mistrust. Political analysts say while these trends are encouraging, most of Africa's young generation is yearning for change, especially in countries where some of the world's longest-serving leaders continue to hold power. Paul Diho, VOA News, Washington.
Thanks, Paul, for that interesting report. Joining us today are three distinguished guests. Manuel Taha, anthropologist and conflict analysis expert and a former senior fellow at the U.S. Institute of Peace and currently a consultant with the same institution. And Dr. Hashim Altine, it is a pleasure to meet you, of course, again.
My privilege and pleasure.
And last but not least, Abdurrahman Dia, a reporter with VOA's French to Africa service, who has been covering the elections in the Democratic Republic of the Congo.
Thank you, Shaka, for having me.
No, you're most welcome. I have to say, frankly, that Manaro and the two gentlemen, I'm profoundly honored and exceedingly humbled to have the opportunity to host you on Straight Talk Africa.
Thank you.
Same here, Shaka.
You're most welcome.
As always.
Yeah. Let me come to you, Manuel, for the first time. This is the first time, in fact, I have had the honor and opportunity to host you on Straight Talk Africa.
Thank you.
You're most welcome. Tell us, what exactly is happening in your home country of the Sudan?
Now in Sudan, we have a movement, local people, lay people in the street. They came out demonstrating against the current regime, which was ruling Sudan since July 30th, 1989. And this three generations grew up in this regime, and now they revolt against it in a very clear revolutions all over. And it started on the states, in the privileged, in the margins of Sudan, and it start up and built up, and now it's in the peak of the capital of Khartoum and Omdurman.
Now, you're talking about the capture of Khartoum, of course. For those in the audience who may not know the dynamics there, we're talking about the triangle capital?
Yes. Now, as I'm speaking now, the peak of demonstration is in Omdurman, which is one of the three capitals in Sudan. We have Khartoum North, called Bahri. We have Omdurman, which is the national capital, and we have Khartoum, which is a political and administration capital. And three of them, they are together. They are the capital of Sudan. It's called Khartoum.
Very interesting, Dr. Hashim.
Yes, sir.
Are we looking at something that the English language would characterize as perhaps deja vu?
Yeah, I have always, as someone who participated as a student leader in 64.
The October Revolution?
Yes, and who was involved in that, who really experienced the whole dynamics.
And you overthrew General Ibrahim Abu?
Yeah, and it was a peaceful movement. It was a civil disobedience, a civil strike.
Triggered by the police having shot and killed.
Exactly. In the campus of the university. And, we just started it. And then the trade union movement, the party, everybody came. It's very interesting. So it's deja vu. What's happening now is, because there is a memory. And that's why, for example, I never lost hope that this will happen. And that's why, in 2017, I published this book, which is called Liberation, A Quest for a New Humanism. It's really a humble effort to turn the tables in terms of the conversation.
Were
not
you
only
trying
in Sudan.
To be a prophet?
No, I mean, maybe coming from the Nile Valley, you know, I definitely am rooted into a certain spirituality, you know, and a certain awareness of ancient history of Africa, you know, and the notions of justice, you know, and freedom, you know.
You seem to have been slightly more organized when it comes to the October Revolution. Is that correct?
Well, I mean, yes, because in retrospect, the university and the whole society at that time was more stable, you know, and the trade union movement was intact, you know, agriculture, farmers and workers, and even the public service, you know, the institutions were all
the doctors,
good. Yeah.
The lawyers.
Exactly. This regime for the last 30 years has done an incredibly cruel job of actually dismantling all of that. It's really beyond me how, in the name of the people and the country and the nation, and its you know, religious and spiritual heritage, you can justify, you know, tyranny and racism and militarism and greed, you know, become king in the society, you know.
But it seems to retain at least the royalty of the institutions of violence. We're talking about the military here.
Yeah, sure. And this is, you see, this regime came in a tank, you know. It's a coup d'etat against an institutionally elected government.
Overthrew Sadiq al-Mahdi.
Exactly. And although, you know, a lot of people were almost cynical about our democratic experiences in Sudan because they always fell short of the expectations of the people. And you see, it's interesting. The Sudanese people have always been ahead of their political elites. They always had a deeper consciousness about the potential, the human potential, but also the natural and the resource potential, and that they always aspired to actually do better. But we never had a government that actually came any way close to the aspirations of the people. That's why it was only logical. And that's why I speak about revolution, because this is the only way to change things.
And when you talk about the Sudanese people, what about the Sudanese army? On whose side is the Sudanese army?
Well,
it has relatives, obviously, among civilians. It experiences perhaps the same socio-economic problems. I mean, if you increase prices for bread, which is Arabic for life, soldiers are also affected. Any particular reason why they continue operating as if, in fact, they were the primary political constituency of Field Marshal Omar al-Bashir?
Because Omar al-Bashir and the regime that supports him, which is the Islamists or the Muslim Brothers, they have been very diabolically opportunistic about playing everybody to maintain their grip on power.
Does he continue to enjoy the royalty of the Islamists, despite the fact that he had actually fallen out with Dr. Hassan al-Turabi?
Well, because it's complicated, because the Islamists also broke into different segments and different tendencies. So they are not totally united. You know, some of them were went with al-Bashir, you know, the group of 10 that signed that petition. And then others went with El Turabi, and they formed the Popular Congress Party, you know, which is actually there now, you know, led by Ali Al-Hajj. So, I mean, you know, the what is important is that the army, the politicians and the Muslim Brothers and the regime have invested heavily in trying to buy the loyalty of all who matter in terms of military, police, militias, and government officials. They dissolved the public service in Sudan, which had a great reputation, you know, and brought people who are followers of theirs, you know, in their clique.
I see. We'll come back to that later. Let's go to Abdu to tell us a little bit about what is happening from the other giant, almost neighboring country to Sudan. We're talking about the Democratic Republic of the Congo, where you spent some time covering an election. Some, in fact, call it a selection.
Yes, well, I think tonight might be the night where they will get the provisional results. Journalists have been called to the headquarters of the Electoral Commission, CENI, and I'm told that Félix Tshisekedi, one of the main contenders, has decided to watch the election results from the headquarters of his party, UDPS. And I'm also told that a lot of journalists are at Martin Fayulu's home as well. So there is definitely some movement there, and hopefully a lot of people will call that a delivery because they have been tired of the process, which has been lasting since 2016. Others are fearing that it could trigger another period if results doesn't go one way or the other, depending on how fair play people will be, or how fair they think the results actually reflect the reality. So it all depends on how people will accept what the commission will proclaim tonight or probably. So there are fear and hope at the same time, I think.
Any particular reason why pundits, some analysts and some observers are saying in order for the election in the DRC to be regarded or considered as having been legitimate, it has to be won by a presidential candidate from the opposition?
Well, it depends. I mean, if you talk to the people from the ruling coalition, they think they have what it takes to have their guy win. But many think that based on, you know, the last years in terms of insecurity and poverty, despite the fact the country being one of the richest in terms of, you know, resources, if you look at the poverty and the insecurity, especially in the eastern part of the country, if they were being rated based on that, a lot of people think that the current regime is not very popular, so that would be hard for any candidate from the FCC, not only Shadary, but anybody, to really win on a fair basis. But that is just the assessment of some. The opposition, both Fayulu and Tshisekedi, who actually are in a bitter rivalry, think they can pull it off. But it all depends on the credibility and of the process, if they think it was fair or not.
You know, you mentioned, of course, the Democratic Republic of Congo as being very wealthy, which is a historical fact. Any particular reason, for example, why it has, for example, the reputation for being so generous, for providing aid to all other countries and people except Congolese?
From what I don't pretend to be a specialist of the DR Congo, but from what I've seen and from just being there three times since 2013, these are just a genius country, people, I would say, and they have everything. But the political grasp and the fact that they haven't been able to move from all this instability and the fight for power, because that ultimately that's what it is. Whether it's in Goma, whether it's in the South Kivu, everywhere, people are fighting for the resources of this country, and including maybe other countries who, you know, who knows. But and I think that's what some people would call a curse. Or if you are oil rich, they would say oil curse. But I don't believe in that. Other countries are also rich, and then they don't have, they are not in that situation. So it's very hard to explain. And I would say the elite has a lot to do with it, the politicians especially, because, you know, a lot of people, when I was very struck when I was there, in the difference between how rich some people are, mostly people are, you know, in office or in power, and the rest of the people. And it is just something people cannot understand. When you go to some of the areas in Kinshasa, you wouldn't think you are in Africa. Very big homes, very rich, and just, you know, a couple of meters away, poverty, you know, striking poverty.
So do you get the sense, like the rich Congolese pretty much live in what you would probably perceive as a foreign country?
Well, a lot of them don't have their family there, that's one. Most of the kids are not there, maybe for security reason, I don't know.
I'm talking but about the wealth.
The West?
The wealth. The houses, for example.
Right.
I'm talking about the property. Wealth.
Yes. Yes, I mean, and even the fact that the U.S. currency, the dollar, is the one that people use there, in opposition to the Congolese franc, says a lot about how, you know, this economy is based on, you know, the outside. A lot of them don't use the local currency.
Abdu, when you were there attending political campaigns, talking to different types of people, did you get the sense that this election or that election was actually being run on the basis of issues, the sort of things that people really wanted or needed, or was it about personalities?
I think it was more about personality. They all have programs, of course. They all have said they would spend billions of dollars in educating the youth, finding jobs. If you go to their websites, that's what they will tell you. But it didn't come out. You know, it was mainly about trusting the CENI, the Electoral Commission. It was about, you know, is Kabila really going to leave, or is he just going to stay around, Vladimir Putin way. So those are the kind of debate, you know, that overshadowed the programs, you know, that what they want really to do. Someone like Martin Fayulu, a former oil exec, you know, Etienne Tshisekedi, even though, you know, it was mostly his father, He did have some experience in terms of traveling. He knows. So, and he has some, you know, people around him. So they all have what it takes in terms of intellect and, you know, leadership. But those issues, the main issues affecting the people, you couldn't really see them as being in the forefront of the campaign, unfortunately.
Yeah, I should, in fact, here take the opportunity to apologize, because yesterday in Shaka Extra Time, through a slip of tongue, I basically identified Felix Tshisekedi as having come from Katanga, which of course is a neighboring area, really. He comes from
Kasai.
And you are talking about Mujimai, for example, which is supposed or regarded as the world's epicenter of diamonds.
Exactly.
And yet, when you actually go to Mbujimayi, as I have been there a couple of times, you sometimes wonder whether, in fact, that particular area is based on an economy of sweet potatoes or something of that sort.
I mean, but to be fair, it's not just the DRC itself. The majority of African countries, they have the means to do better. But, you know, the elite, there is just a disconnect between those who are ruling, or who are the politicians in general, not just the ruling people, but even the opposition, and the rest of the country. And as a professor was saying earlier, there is, I mean, usually the people are ahead of their political leaders, and that's unfortunate. They know better, they want to do better, but, you know, the regime has the military, they have everything to keep them at bay, and that's the problem.
You're talking about the land of Patrice Emery Lumumba.
Exactly.
A man who was supposed to be heroic, a heroic figure, really, for Africa.
He is.
And especially for the poor and the voiceless. Mm-hmm. What happened?
Well, that's a long dissertation, maybe, for a professor here. It's what happened is basically, I think, what I was saying. People not following up and not believing in their country. But rather believing in themselves and serving themselves instead of serving the people. And that's common. It's, yes, DRC is pretty striking, but you can say that about a lot of countries in Africa as well.
Talking about a lot of countries, what about the Sudan? The Sudan, in fact, until it split in two, used to be the largest country on the African continent in terms of land, incredible resources, and yet people very poor. Do you agree, Manar, with some who say that part of the reason is because in their words, not mine, there is what they characterize as the leadership deficit?
Yes, Sudan is not different from the rest of African countries. It's not. We inherited the same problems, starting from the leadership, ending by the legislations, and also about the constitutions. Our constitution has been changed a lot. And since 1956, when January 1st, when we had the independence, and we have the national our national governments, we inherited the issues of governments leaders that actually manipulated the constitutions, and also we inherited the issues of military coup. All this brought a lot of political vacuum, political crisis in the country, let alone that we have a problem of we have the problem of for example the economy. Sudan, one of the countries that we have a big debt on, based on the IMF statistics. The economy reform is not really met the people needs. And I will just connect it back to what you said about how actually you have resources in Africa, for example, in Congo, but you have the poverty. You see a very mansioned, rich neighborhood. Immediately across it, you find a very poor neighborhood. First of all, the corporations and business men and business, big businesses and companies, they don't being held accountable for their social responsibilities in the countries.
There is no accountability.
No accountability, corruptions, and also no social responsibilities. Mm-hmm. And if you look at the taxes that they're paying, it's not really equal from what actually they gain. And there is no a legal framework to put them accountable to pay their duties back to their communities. This is not number one. Then we have the rigid leadership. Our leadership is prefer an ethnic groups for this other group, and then economic exploitations for a specific region. Sudan used to be one of the biggest country in terms of land and resources, but unfortunately,
unfortunately, the largest on the African continent.
Our leaders and our country went through a longest war in the continent, and as a result of that, we had two Sudans, South Sudan and North and Sudan, and because of that, South Sudan gets their independent, then. We at the Sudan country, we lost a lot of resources, mainly the oil, which is located in South Sudan. Well, then you have the Chinese getting this oil.
Unfortunately, time happens not to be our best ally. We shall continue with a bit of that later. You are tuned into Straight Talk Africa. We'll have more of a discussion in a moment, so please don't go away, because we'll be right back with you.
We're talking about the news and issues you're talking about,
sharing stories of development and growth across Africa,
around the world, and in our lives. Topics that inform, empower,
and change the rules.
It's time for Our Voices with me, Heidi Adams Fitzpatrick,
and Hadiza Kiari,
and Ayan Bior,
and Orion Itangi Shaka.
It's time for Our Voices.
We are able to touch on things that are important to people on an everyday basis. We hope that our viewers are getting inspired when they watch our show. They're getting a view of the world from a different perspective, things that perhaps are not in their immediate vicinity. Today, I could put in on the show something that is a little different, a little unique, and this gives me that inspiration to come to work.
Today's youth are not just the next generation of African leaders, they are today's leaders. And this is the time to invest in them, today, not tomorrow. So let's connect, let's engage with each other on issues that will transform our societies.
Innovation, leadership, entrepreneurship, things that you're doing to move the continent forward to make you the greatest generation that Africa has known.
It's Upfront every Wednesday, 17:30 UTC, right here on The Voice of America.
A reminder that we appreciate all of the audience feedback. Straight Talk Africa streams live every Wednesday on Facebook. Now let's look at what's on tap for next week's program.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, democratic governments are on display worldwide, but some Africans have concerns that Western versions of democracy are being imposed on the continent. Are democratic governments what's best for Africa? We'll discuss the issue on the next Straight Talk Africa.
And today we are discussing the challenges of political transitions in Africa. Our guests are Manaro Taha, anthropologist and conflict analysis expert, and Dr. Hashib Eritine, founder and president of the International Peace Quest Institute. Well, again, ladies and gentlemen, I have to say that I'm profoundly honored and exceedingly humbled to have the opportunity to host the two of you on Straight Talk Africa.
Thank you.
We are doubly so.
You're most welcome. Now, talking about Tabule, if Abdi had not gone, I would have, of course, asked him if he had, in fact, paid a courtesy call at a place called, there's a place in Kinshasa, a great place where most musicians really, had to go through in order to be who they became. But unfortunately, he's not here. Let me come to you, Doctor. You listened to Manaro. Do you agree with her?
Oh, yeah. I will add, first of all, let us pray for the lives of the martyrs of the revolution in Sudan. There are over 30 or 50. I just was on the phone with people inside, who are collaborating with us, in this new movement, which is called the Freedom, Peace, and Unity Movement for a New Sudan, that we are organizing with all what's happening now, trying to create a mechanism where people can really come together and start anew and walk a new walk towards something better. But so they told me that Manali spoke about the demonstrations in Omdurman, you know, the traditional capital. And they told me that 5 people were shot today, just about 2 hours ago. One of them is in critical situation. Many people actually, my friends, you know, they died who are in the fight for civil, you know, for dignity and for freedom and for peace in the Sudan. Many of them died of sadness about the reality that they see in, before their eyes, and the difference and the distance between, and the gap between their aspirations and the mediocrity of the reality of governance, which is a tyrannical governance. And it's obvious to everybody. So I just wanted to mention that. But let me go back to what he was saying and what you were saying about Kinshasa, because I was there way back. But I wanted, and you mentioned Lumumba. You know, when we were in high school, we, when Lumumba was assassinated, we walked into a demonstration from about maybe 20 miles.
You're talking about the early 1960s here.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. We walked from our school, boarding school, to the capital to demonstrate before the Belgian embassy and against that. So this is interesting because that played a role in our own consciousness about African issues and African problems, you know, and, you know, imperialism, colonialism, and all these things.
Have you been to Kinshasa?
Yeah, I've been to Kinshasa, and I love Congolese music. It's amazing.
Now, you're talking about Congolese music.
Amazing.
When you are in Kinshasa, have you ever found time, for example, to pay a courtesy call at a place called Matonge?
Yes, of
that
course.
That is the cultural epicenter.
Yeah, absolutely.
Not only of Congo, perhaps of Africa, really.
Yeah, of Africa, and it reminds me, actually, of Fela Ransom Kuti's Africa Shrine in Lagos, because I worked as a diplomat in Lagos, and I used to go and hang out with him after in the evenings, you know?
So you used to enjoy music by the late greats like Franco, Rwamba Yamakiadi,
exactly.
Mario.
Amazing. And till today, I listen to Congolese music. It's amazing. Amazing. I mean, these people are
Biria
so creative.
Bear.
Huh?
Mbiria Bear.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
Tabule Losheru.
Yeah, you know them very well. I mean, yes, wonderful, yeah.
Kofi Olomide.
Mm-hmm.
Who is still alive and still a mega star.
Right. And, you know, we have the Senegalese and we have the Kora. I mean, it's amazing. Africa is so rich. Not only in resources. We right. always speak right. about resources. Right. Africa is rich in ingenuity and in creativity and innovation.
And poor in
but
what?
But we need...
Poor in what? Organization?
No.
Management?
We have to have the right vision. You know...
Poor in accountability?
It said that...
All above.
Great in institutionalizing corruption and impunity?
Well, this is all happening because we never really agreed on an enlightened vision of governance.
But this is not really Africa. This is about specific individuals who have had the opportunity to be at the political harems of their countries.
Yes. But the French say, la plus belle femme du monde ne peut te donner que ce qu'elle a. The most beautiful woman in the world can't give you but what she has. So these people, they don't have the right vision to inspire them to do better. That's all what they know. That's the problem.
Manar talked a little bit earlier, for example, about Sudan, about the issue of changing constitutions. Is that really a big deal?
Well,
in a situation like that, do you even use or are you really even tempted to use the word or the concept of constitution? Because some of these individual rulers really have sort of transformed these Yukoro constitutions into personal manifestos, really.
Well, I agree with you totally. And the solution is to go back to the people, to give them freedom, and so that they can be more conscious, and then choose people who can do the right thing.
Do
by
you
them.
You give them right, freedom? Who right. is going to give the people freedom? I thought that is something that people the have people, to take.
Well, that's what I mean. People have to take it. People are now marching and dying in the streets for their freedom. This is what they need. And this is all Africans need that. And I believe that if Africans can enjoy freedom of speech and thought and freedom of organization and enjoy in their constitutions enshrined freedom, peace, justice and unity,
dignity,
there is nothing that can stop them from actually creating, converting or transforming Africa into a garden of Eden,
of
humanity.
How do you respond to some who say that a vast majority of Africans really, all they care about is things they can touch and feel? That when you talk about democracy, you talk about dignity. Those types of things, an average African does not really relate to you, does not know what you're talking about. In fact, there have been some African rulers who have even asked their populations whether they can eat that thing called democracy.
You know, we often say here...
Is democracy, for example, and service delivery, are they mutually exclusive or are they mutually reinforcing?
Well, it's often said here in this town and in the States and in the world that education is the most important investment in any human being.
Quality education.
Quality education, of course. Quality education, that's what I mean. And so it goes back to awareness. Education, awareness. And it goes back to the people. There is no power on earth that can stop a united, conscious people who desire to be free, to have peace, to enjoy peace, and to enjoy dignity, and who are ready to walk, march in the streets to ask for that. That is the power, because power is in the people. When people, that's why, you know, in Salam Sudan Foundation and the International Peace Quest Institute, our vision is peace-centered. We believe that people shouldn't be angry and shouldn't destroy anything. All what they need to do, they have the power. To be conscious that power is in them, in each one of them, and that they should unite around a vision that inspires them, that empowers them, you see, that actually liberates them from the dominant confusion, you know, and garbage, you know, of political politicking, you know, like ping pong and all the games that are there. That's why people, by the way, that's why the Sudanese people waited and have been patient for 30 years. It's not because they are not revolutionary. They are very revolutionary, authentically revolutionary.
But look at the neighborhood where the Sudan is situated.
But because the political discourse that they hear from everybody never inspired them. That's why they stayed put and they were just watching these politicians until this event that made them mad about not having bread and butter and so on. And
are you suggesting that they were not inspired, for example, by the events in Tahrir Square, Egypt, about 4 years ago? And what about what has actually been happening in neighboring Ethiopia, Addis Ababa?
You mean the recent developments?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you know, in terms of the knowledge and the consciousness of the people, these people come from with very accumulated experience in terms of revolutionary, mass revolution, peaceful revolutionary change. Mm-hmm. I told you about October. They did it in April 85, mm. October 64, April 85 against Nemeri, you know, and now they are doing it. Of course, the players have changed. You know, these people have been playing too much and very hard, you know, and dividing people, divided the country, divided the people, tribalism. I mean, all kinds of things. So now, this time around, they are learning all these lessons of suffering. They had endured incredible suffering, incredible indignity, incredible tyranny.
Dr. Hashim, there are some people who say that it is men who really have done very, very bad things too. Not only the Sudan, mm-hmm. but to Africa, that perhaps the positive solutions need to be found from Africa's women. Let's go to Manar.
Yeah, now you have a good examples now in Ethiopia. You have a new woman as a president. So, mm-hmm. Solution is not cannot come just from a woman. It has to be men and women together. And I don't want to go away from your questions. If Sudan being inspired by what's happening in Tahrir Square, we had September Revolution before. And people went out and they've been killed. And September Revolution, it's last year and the year before, but the regime is really, they're having their ways to suppress these voices. Just I want to say that for the records. Having a woman as a half of the manpower on Africa is being taken away. This power and this resource has been taken away for many reasons. And in many countries, I will tell you that, for example, in your home country, Uganda, the constitution just recently in 1990s gave the women the right to own properties. And in the past, we know that in Africa, we have patriarchal communities, and the land issue is land is the resources. And more than 80% women are actually cultivate these lands, but they don't own it.
They don't own it.
For example, South Sudan is a big example.
They're
workers.
They're basically producers.
Exactly.
But have no right to own their product.
And you have half of the nation on the resources and the other half work on it. So that imbalance, and that's part of the dysfunctioning economy in Africa, not only just in my home country. Sudan is a little bit different in terms of women owning properties. It's having back on the history, but many African countries are suffering, specifically women. And of course, there's a lot of legal constraints for women to come out and to participate. Even in my home country, equal payment is not even they didn't even have the time to ask this question because there is a lot of laws and legislations that are putting women back, not only just to have be at the middle level of leadership, at the lower level, let alone at the high level. There is some representation at the high level at the governments, but usually it's selected. And they don't speak they speak more about their political parties. Mm. They don't represent the majority of the big majority of women are suffering at the local level.
I think this is a good place to inject in this discussion the awareness and the consciousness of the youth who are actually now spearheading the revolution in Sudan. The youth, she spoke about the youth who are like 30 years or 40 years, and they lived into this tyranny, So they know all the tricks.
There's no question that there are people who believe that a combination, for example, of the changing demographics, mm-hmm. you call youth,
yeah,
together with social media.
Oh, absolutely.
That is bound.
Oh, absolutely.
To bring about the sort of revolutions that are very badly needed.
Absolutely.
On the African continent.
Absolutely.
And actually, these authoritarian regimes in most of African countries, they don't provide spaces for youth to be part of the decision-making process. And that is part of the instability in these countries.
They don't provide jobs.
And not only jobs. It's just being a part of decision-making, being a part of...
Being consulted.
Being a part of the whole state mechanism and dynamics. For example, in many countries now you have the population more than 60% in many countries, in African countries, they are youth.
Young people. Youth. Very young.
Less than,
they are not invested,
younger than 30
They are not invested in the status quo.
No. So
they have no new skill sets. They have no jobs. They have no dreams. They have no tomorrow.
And then the disconnection.
The only interest, frankly, is change.
The disconnections between those people, those young people, they're looking for, they see how people outside the countries, they have the world in their hands through the phone. Mm. But they see themselves, they don't have any role in their own communities. So they are this gap. So the only way they fill that gap is to make the change, to get those old people that they're controlling since 1950s, and African old men controlling everything, they don't give space for them.
There
so it's
people,
a legitimate movement for
Manaro,
them.
There are people who say that there is a very important institution in Africa that has been misused, for example, by democratically challenged rulers on the continent, and that is the military, the security forces. And yet, the members of the security forces are related to the rest of the community. How can you, for example, use some kind of civic education among the members of the security forces in order to see themselves as part of the people, not part of the individual rulers?
So independence for the military forces, it's important for stability. And also it's part of the guarantee for a democratic process.
When you talk about stability, what are you talking about? Who's stability here?
A stability of civil war, stability of the institutions function within order. So that's what I mean.
Can society
production
be considered a stable where it is on empty stomachs?
No, it's not. It's a very high trigger for fight, mm-hmm. and for we have to understand that military has a different way of doing things. They have an order. They came from the community, but they are governed by orders. So that is part of the whole psychology of being a military. But at the same times, there is a huge branch, and in most of the what we call a developed country, a civilian military relationships.
But how can you, for example, figure out a way of having a conversation with members of the military, members of the security forces, that, ladies and gentlemen, I'm talking about if in fact the army is both men and women, you happen to be on the side of the people, that your job, your role is to protect the people, not the individual rulers?
That is very difficult questions to pose to the military, because for a long time in many African countries, military seen themselves as supporter or protector for the ruler more than the country and
but
the
some
country.
Some of the top rulers look or regard their military as the people's army. They call the army that it belongs to the people. Which people are those?
Their own people, their own political party,
themselves,
unfortunately.
Yeah.
So it's the military has to defend the country from outsider enemy, not inside. The nation should not be the enemy for the military.
But you know better than that. You know that these militaries are used domestically.
Yes, and that is the wrong. And that's
they
when
are
you
used
have
in elections.
And that's when you have a broken state, and then when you have a conflict, and when you have the military itself, it became a group, grouping within the military. And that is the time you're going to have very difficult to do any transitional, peaceful transitional from governance to other governments, or even the democratic process to be peacefully and protected by the military. So that is the African problems. It's not only just in Sudan.
There used to be a scholar, a very progressive scholar from Tanzania, known as Abdulrahman Babu. He even taught at Amherst College in the United States. He used to be a minister in Tanzania. He used to talk about how you can look at some military coups as progressive military coups. And one of the examples he used to give was the 1952 coup in Egypt, led, of course, by Colonel Gamal.
Mohammed Najib.
Well, it wasn't exactly Najib, even though Najib, by the way, had a Sudanese mother.
Yes.
It was Gamal Abdel Nasser. He was junior in rank, so when they overthrew the pharaoh, they decided to use Naguib as the first military head of state.
Right.
But Mr. Babu used to regard that military, for example, coup, as something really that was very revolutionary and very, very positive. Do you agree with him?
Well, this is actually the syndrome that is that brought Gaddafi and many and Assad.
But the soldiers were on the side of the people.
And, you know, and Saddam and a lot of military people. And even in Africa, I mean, in Ghana and all this, you know, they overthrew Nkrumah, for example.
But Gamal Abdel Nasser was arguably a great leader.
Yeah, so this was the precedent that inspired this coup culture, you know, as a shortcut, you know, to just go to the radio station and say, I am the boss, and you listen to me. You see my point? And it's an easy way out. What we are trying now from our Sudanese experience and all what's the suffering that we are going through is that there are no shortcuts and there is no free lunch. With the social media, with the youth of Africa and Sudan and all and the Arab countries and all, everywhere, even here. It's now how the quality of education you spoke about.
Unfortunately, Dr. Hashim, time happens not to be our best ally.
All right.
I think we reserve some comments and analysis for the next edition of Straight Talk Africa.
All right.
Well, on that note, thanks to our distinguished guests for today, Manar Taha, Hashim Erutine, and Abdulrahman Dia joined us earlier. And thanks to our audience for tuning into Straight Talk Africa. In the meantime, get better, not bitter, Africa. And please remember to keep the African hopes alive.